Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, March 23rd, 2015. The head of World Food Program warns of a looming food crisis in South Sudan.
The longer the crisis goes on, the more people suffer. And the more the suffering spreads to those who may have the ability to eat today, tomorrow they'll have nothing.
And UNICEF reunites hundreds of South Sudanese child soldiers with their families.
Of the 660 children that were demobilized and released in the first January through early February, we now have about 200 children who are about to be reunited with their family.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of World Food Program is warning that famine could be declared in parts of South Sudan if 15 months of fighting does not end soon. Catherine Cousin says she saw plenty of evidence of severe food insecurity this past weekend when she visited parts of South Sudan hard hit by the conflict. Waki Simon Wudu recently traveled with Cousin to Unity State, where thousands of displaced South Sudanese are sheltering, and has this report for VOA from Juba.
This is Cousin's second visit to South Sudan in 4 months, and this time the World Food Program Executive Director says she is sounding the alarm for the young country.
The challenge is that even people who had something when I was here the last time, they've depleted those assets, and now they have even less, or they have nothing. And so the longer the crisis goes on, the more people suffer. And the more the suffering spreads to those who may have the ability to eat today, tomorrow they'll have nothing.
Cousin spent her 3 days in South Sudan meeting with the government officials, representatives of aid organizations, and internally displaced persons or IDPs in the rebel-controlled Payam Ganiel in Unity State. She also took a boat into the Sut wetlands to meet with the people who have sought shelter from the fighting in an island. Cousin was given a jubilant welcome by some of the thousands of IDPs who are sheltering in Ganiel and the surrounding area in Panyijar County in southern Unity State. Ganiel is around 80 miles south of the state capital, Bentiu, which a UN official described last year as having been wiped off the map in the fighting. People from Bentiu, from Malakal, the capital of Upper Nile State, and parts of Jongole State have sought shelter in Ganiel. The IDPs and host families in the area survive on aid supplied by humanitarian agencies, including the WFP. Cousin says the IDPs in Ganiel face very harsh conditions.
I talked to women who've walked over 200 miles with 6 and 7 children to find food. Their husbands have been killed, but what they know is they had to keep walking because their children had no food.
Cousin says host families in Ganiel are struggling too. She says the host families are sharing the little they have with the IDPs.
It is important that the world recognize that same spirit, that we must share what we have with these victims in South Sudan who without us have nothing.
The U.S. ambassador to the U.N. agencies in Rome, David Lane, accompanied Cousin on the weekend trip to Ganiel and to a U.N. IDP camp in Juba. Lane says he is saddened that South Sudan has slid back into conflict. He says that when he visited here 2 years ago,
the kinds of projects we saw then were not just about feeding people and keeping them alive, but were actually about transforming rural agriculture. It's hard enough to develop an economy with challenging weather and other challenging conditions that a place like South Sudan faces.
The IDPs in Ganiel are just a fraction of the 1.5 million internally displaced South Sudanese who have been forced from their homes since December 2013 when fighting erupted between forces loyal to President Salva Kiir and rebels allied with the former Vice President Riek Machar. More than 100,000 IDPs are sheltering in several UN camps across the country. A staggering 4 million people in South Sudan will need assistance by the end of the year, and 2.5 million are facing severe levels of food insecurity now, UN humanitarian officials say. The government and rebels have been holding negotiations for more than a year to end the fighting, but the talks have not yielded a peace deal that sticks. The most recent attempt to reach peace ended in failure earlier this month, and fighting has flared up in parts of South Sudan since then. Cousin says South Sudan's suffering people are the innocent victims of a pointless war.
We need peace so that people can go back to their homes and back to their lives. But until then, we need the world to know that there are victims who are not part of this conflict, who just want to have the ability to feed their children, to have the health care that they need, to have the support that's required so that we don't lose an entire generation while an unnecessary war goes on.
For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Former rebels of the South Sudan Democratic Army, Cobra Faction, who signed a peace agreement with Juba last year, released more than 400 children over the weekend. UNICEF says since January, the armed group has freed more than 1,300 child soldiers. For VOA News, Charlton Doki has this story from Juba.
UNICEF says the freed children range in age from 9 to 17. John Budd, the UNICEF spokesperson in South Sudan, says four girls are among the child soldiers released during a ceremony on Saturday in Pibor.
Approximately 250 children were released in that ceremony. So what you saw there were children who handed over the weapons, handed over their uniforms, and were then supplied with civilian clothes. And then UNICEF took them to an interim care centre nearby and fed them and gave them shelter. And the same thing happened yesterday with another 100-plus children.
This is the third time this year the armed group has released child soldiers, Bud says. Two to three other releases are scheduled over the next month. He says Cobra Faction leaders have informed UNICEF and Demobilization, Disarmament and Reintegration Commission officials that they will release some 3,000 child soldiers in all. Bud says it has been a brutal life for most of these children.
They report to us in many instances that they have witnessed all sorts of traumas, either to themselves, in fighting. Some have even told us that they have been witness to death and to injuries amongst their families. Many of them have also said that they have, over a period of time, been beaten or tortured. So although, you know, they look like fit young men principally, we assess them very carefully medically when they come to us.
Bud says in the next few weeks, UNICEF will be working to trace the children's families and reintegrate them into their communities.
When the children are registered with the National Disarmament and Demobilization Reintegration Commission, there is a form that is filled out, and it's quite a detailed form which details all the history of where they came from and the names of their parents. So we actually do have a very good starting point for looking for the families. And the really good news is of the 660 children that were demobilized and released in the first January through early February, when we started to trace them back to their families, we now have about 200 children who are about to be reunited with their family.
And Bud says another 200 children should be reunited with their families soon. UNICEF says many of these children have been fighting for the last 4 years and have never attended school. Bud says UNICEF will either provide the children with an education or some form of vocational training.
The thing that these children have repeatedly told the commission, the government commission, and also UNICEF, is that they want to go back to school, they want to start learning again. Of course, you know, children, we hope, with the incentive of education, will remain in their communities. I mean, that's the key thing for UNICEF. Nothing is guaranteed, but if we provide a young boy or a girl with something that they can hold on to, it provides us with a better opportunity for them to stay with their families.
The UN says up to 12,000 South Sudanese children are continuing to fight for various armed groups in the country. BAD is calling on the South Sudan government and armed groups to release all child soldiers immediately and unconditionally.
I think what is happening in Peabor and around Peabor is an example of what could be done if we all work together, and UNICEF is ready to support any armed force, any armed group, to release their children. If they would help us, we will help them, and importantly, get these children back to a normal life.
The government's National Demobilization, Disarmament and Reintegration Commission says it's working with UNICEF to facilitate the release of all child soldiers in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Juba.
South Sudan and Sudan have taken a step toward finally mapping out their border. Last week, high-ranking officials from the two countries agreed at a meeting in Addis Ababa to set up an account to fund the task of demarcating the boundary. After 3 days of talks, the officials agreed that a team of surveyors, map makers, and other experts from both sides will map out the border. They also agreed on how the demarcation committee will go about its work, although no details were given. Portions of the border have been in dispute since South Sudan became independent from Sudan in July 2011. The main areas of contention are the Abyei region, which is under United Nations administration, and the Nuba Mountains region in Sudan. The African Union helped to broker last week's agreement and says it is an encouraging step towards demarcating another disputed African border. Information Minister Michael Makuei signed the agreement on behalf of South Sudan, and State Minister at the Presidency, Al-Rashid Harun Adam, signed for Sudan. Yesterday was World Water Day, so we decided to take a closer look at how most people in South Sudan access clean water. Many families in the capital rely on water transported from the Nile River to various communities by truck. Others get their water from hand pumps on top of a borehole. There is no constant source of clean water, but as Philip Thornaleu reports from Juba, authorities say if their master plan is followed, one day there will be clean water in the area.
Lawrence Molunyang, Director General of Planning at the South Sudan Urban Water Corporation, says only a third of people in town have five water. And Molunyang says that structure is dilapidated. But he says efforts are underway to increase the capital's water supply. He says Japan International Cooperation Agency is one of the country's international supporters for a new water treatment facility.
We are building a new water treatment plant in Juba of capacity 10,800. By the end of next year, it will be complete, and we are going to increase coverage levels for Juba.
Malunyang says Japan provided $48 million for the water plant in Juba. He says residents outside of Juba will continue receiving clean water by truck.
The tankers will still continue in the outlying areas of Juba because the network is very small. But if you are within the town center, Gudele, Munuki, you will always have access.
Malunyang acknowledges much more must be done to reach the required minimal standard of maintaining a clean and constant water supply for Juba residents. He says many homes in Juba use pit latrines, which compromise the drinking water supply access through bar holes. He says cholera, a waterborne disease, is often reported in Juba, a clear sign that the water is contaminated in many areas. Christopher Swaka, the mayor of Juba municipality, says panding continues to be a problem.
Business of services is not a cheap business. You know, it's not a cheap business. It's a business that needs a lot of funding in its development until people can have the basic service of water. We're talking to our governments in general. Also, we're talking to our development partners and donors that, you know, but let's come and coordinate and put our efforts together so that we can be able to spell out what are our priorities and how best we can be able to go, you know, about them.
Swaka says the city 15-year master plan addresses the challenges of getting water 5 to every home in the capital. Juba City Sanitation Report and Investment Plan slated to run from January 2015 to January 2030 estimates that 55% of the town's residents will have access to clean water by the year 2020. That figure could raise to 70% by 2025 and 80% by 2030. Molunyang says the citizens have the right to expect clean drinking water at their homes. In order to accomplish that, all citizens must cooperate.
People must dump waste in designated places like Roton. That is a good treated place where we treat waste, not throwing it anyhow. You remember on Yei Road some time back, people used to dump waste. It is now controlled. We hope slowly, slowly people will realize that.
Malunyang says town authorities have assured him that the law will be strictly imposed on maintaining clean water sources. Only 32% of people residing in South Sudan's main towns have access to fresh water, according to a new report released last month by the USAID-funded Sustainable Water and Sanitation Project in Africa, or SWASA. Of the 1.3 million people living in the six cities of Bor, Juba, Maridi, Malakal, Ring, and Wau, only 438,000 have access to fresh water, according to SWASA. In rural areas, people rely on natural sources such as streams and rivers for clean water. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, some South Sudanese entrepreneurs find sweet way to supplement their income. Find out what it is when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how has your culture shaped who you are?
My culture, it shaped just who I am right now, because it's given me something I value, and I know what to do and what I can't do, what is just respectable and what is not respectable.
Basically, what culture has shaped me in my life is it has taught me different core values, how to respect elders, how to respect people around me, and it has taught me how to live with others in the community.
My culture have shaped me to be polite and to be honest.
My culture, it has shaped me in different ways, particularly in things regarding time management, regarding education.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Now we turn to Nigeria, where there has been unprecedented political upheaval over the past 2 years. As the country prepares for elections on Saturday, the ruling People's Democratic Party is facing its first real challenge since coming to power at the end of military rule in 1999. VOA's Anne Luke reports from Abuja on the rise of Nigeria's lead opposition party, the All Progressive Congress.
At least three regional Nigerian parties came together to form the mega opposition party, the APC, in February 2013. It was a first for Nigeria, and naysayers said the new party would implode. But then prominent PDP members started jumping ship for the APC.
The headline story this week is the massive defection of some lawmakers in the House of Representatives.
Five governors came on board at once, then 37 representatives, then 11 senators, and the defections continued. But the momentum stalled in 2014 as the PDP rebounded, with a new party leader and efforts to reconcile. The defections started going both ways.
The most recent cross, 5,000 APC members in Kaduna State rejoined the PDP.
This back and forth continues even now, with just days to go before presidential and parliamentary elections. The APC and the PDP keep gaining and losing members. Analysts say results of the March 28th vote could kick off another wave of party swapping ahead of governor and state assembly races April 11th.
You find people jumping ship, you know, quite unashamedly to the party of the president-elect.
Dawn Damowo is a political analyst at the strategy firm Africa Practice in Abuja. She says the ground the APC broke in Nigerian party politics had a lot to do with good timing.
They were able to capitalize on the fact that, you know, there was disenchantment within the PDP. There were people who were willing to quit the party and move to the APC. So it got a big boost from that.
One of the main points of contention, whether President Goodluck Jonathan had broken the PDP agreement to rotate the presidency between North and South. Some within the PDP believed the North was owed another term when Mr. Jonathan, a Southerner, ran and won in 2011. But Nigerian political scientist Kabir Mato says the APC is riding a sea change.
Citizens are gradually inching away from the traditional politics of ethnicity, religion, regionalism, to a politics of dividends of democracy. I think it's simply the desire that there should exist, you know, an alternative that could give a platform for people in the event that we are dissatisfied with what's happening here.
Mr. Jonathan has brushed off the defections, such as politics, he told reporters in a televised media chat in February.
There's no permanent friends or permanent enemy. Yes, there are permanent interests.
The APC has a majority in the House. It counts 14 out of Nigeria's 36 governors. But Mr. Jonathan has the incumbent advantage. The ruling party is also seen as having benefited from the six-week election postponement over security issues in the north. But the vote still looks too close to call. APC presidential candidate Muhammadu Buhari dominated the mostly Muslim north in the 2011 vote, but did poorly in the south. The APC has campaigned hard there this time, with Mr. Buhari swinging through the region again this week. Political analyst Demowo says the Southwest tops her watch list.
He's going to pick up a lot more votes in the South this time around than he did in 2011. And that's, you know, eroding the PDP's base. So it's quite interesting to see what's going to happen.
The APC has cast this election as a referendum on 16 years of PDP rule. The party's symbol is a broom, and it's pledging a clean sweep. But some wonder how much of an alternative the APC really is. There's a fair bit of the PDP old guard in this new party, and probably more will join if Mr. Buhari wins. And look, VOA News, Abuja.
And now for some good news from South Sudan. Some South Sudanese entrepreneurs have rediscovered a novel way to increase their income just by beekeeping. For decades, South Sudan was known for producing some of the finest honey in the world. But years of neglect, insecurity, and conflict have crippled the industry. Now beekeeping is on the rise. Mungume Debs Rakarinj visited some beekeeping villages to find out why.
As you enter Eastern Equatorial State's Bora village, about 150 kilometers from Juba, the sound of insects and birds can be as overpowering as the sweet fragrance of the ever-flowering plants that flourish as far as the eye can see. Various pink, purple, and yellow wildflowers brighten the brownish-green savanna vegetation even during dry season in Bora. That is one of the reasons it is known as the Honey Village. Travel about 4 kilometers deep in the bush near Bora, and you see pots, hollowed-out tree trunks, and traditional beehives hanging in trees alongside modern ones, including four belonging 32-year-old Jacob Okela. In 2008, Okela was collecting firewood in the forest when he saw bees in a tree trunk. The sight gave him an idea.
In the bush, when you get a good tree, you cut that tree, you burn inside the tree. And then you bring the tree and then you put in the group. The bee also, they come and enter in that beehive there.
He eventually made a traditional beehive using bunches of sticks. And with that, his beekeeping career began. With the help of an American NGO, Okela formed a beekeeping group whose members were trained to maintain modern hives. Okela says you have to be patient. It can take as long as 4 weeks to attract enough bees with honeycomb or sugar to form an active colony.
You put it inside. The bee also, they need sweet things. And then they come and enter in that beehive there.
Okela earns at least 2,400 South Sudanese pounds per season from the raw liquid honey he extracts. That pays the school fees for his four children. there's another dividend for beekeepers. They consider young bee larvae a tasty delicacy. Honey itself is a nutritious food. It contains natural minerals and vitamins which help metabolize so-called bad cholesterol and fatty acids. It is also used to prevent infection and kill bacteria. Eugenio Oboya from Parjok Payam says he has been keeping bees for more than four decades.
My father was a beekeeper, traditional beekeeper, and I used to go with him out to harvest, to side the hives, and to do our activities related to beekeeping. So I developed a liking for that from my early childhood. Yeah.
How old were you then?
I was about 10 years old only.
And how old are you now?
Oh, I'm now 73.
Okay, and you love what you're doing?
Sure, I love it so much anyway. Yeah, I love it really.
After several trips to Kenya and Uganda to observe beekeeping practices, Oboya now makes an improved wooden beehive for easier harvesting.
The frames are typically the of the Langstroth hive, and the front part is the brooding chamber, the brood chamber, with a deeper sort of frame.
From the profits of his 11 modern hives, Oboya built a house, bought a motorbike, and sent his children to school. He thinks South Sudan should start producing high-quality honey domestically.
We are looking at processing the honey locally. That's what we would like to see here. Not that our honey is taken away and being processed somewhere else. We could do it here.
But beekeeping is not easy. Oboya says some beehives are destroyed by wild bush fires set by hunters searching for bush meat, while others are destroyed by red ants or monkeys who eat honey and bees. Matata Safi is a community development manager for Honey Care Africa, an East African company which helps farmers supplement their income through beekeeping. Safi says bees are also important because they pollinate plants which boost farmers' yields. Safi says since working here, they have recruited over 1,000 beekeepers in Western Equatoria, Eastern Equatoria, and Central Equatoria states. Last year, they exported 30 metric tons of unprocessed liquid honey to Kenya. Safi says honey gives South Sudan a chance to diversify its economy.
At the moment, the oil prices have dropped in the world market, and a country to only entirely depend on one resource, it is a bit catastrophic if there are problems that affect that sector.
In Magu County, honey dealer Bongomin Nelson sells honey by the roadside in 5-liter containers. Tell us now, Debeka?
£10.
This is £10?
5-liter.
Okay. Is it good?
My tegol.
Okay, but is it good? De tamam?
Tamam.
Okay, let me test and see if it is tamam. It's good, huh? Yeah, man. For VOA News, Ajam Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Sika Andaya by Amir Juba.
David Stewart Warkozi, producer Isaac Isanga. Amir Katolo Sim. Papa betala sabagalo masi shoko, abo betala sabagalo masi shoko. Belefo beka de lebe sandaya, belefo beka de lebe sandaya. Kuliyom sikandaya mini saba, kuliyom sikandaya mini saba,
kuliyom sikandaya.
Ale kolo betala tala, betala minabe. At
fal golu bi jere jere bi jere min albe nyer ku kat golu bi tala tala bi tala min albe at fal golu bi jere jere bi jere min albe.
We have been listening to Amir Juba with the song Sikandaya. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thank you for allowing us into your homes and cars. Remember to join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.